The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 5, where the vibes are high and the knowledge is hot. And the teaching pearls are served with a side of etouffee. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyflein, joined by my co-host and queen of clinician ed, Jazz, Dr. Ira Krzyzanowskaia. Today, we're coming at you straight from the heart of the action, live and in person at AIM Week 25. We're feeling that French Quarter fever and ready to jazz things up with the sweetest beignet reflections and crawfish spicy insights from our favorite workshops. But before we buy you too deep, Ira, remind the good people what we do on this show.
Of course, Molly. Here in Curbsiders Teach, we bring the funk to health professions education. We're your go-to crew for expert interviews, teaching pearls, and practice-changing knowledge designed to inspire the next generation of clinician educators to second-line their way into greatness. Whether you're a medical student, resident, faculty, health professions educator or learner, or just here for the gumbo of ideas, we've got you covered. And today's episode is a total Marty party, featuring our brilliant guests, Drs. Vidya Gopinath, Sarah Vick, Jen Spicer, and Siobhan Onuma. This combo's got more flavor than a pot of jambalaya, and we're excited to share it with you.
We're thrilled to bring this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. Here's the lineup. Most of our episodes are available for a CME credit through VCU Health CE for all you fabulous health professionals, but this one probably isn't. Just head to curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And a shout out to our amazing Patreon fam. Y'all keep the brass band playing and the learning rolling. If you haven't joined yet, don't miss out. Come on over and keep us stirring this educational gumbo. Let the good times teach. Thank you to ChatGPT for these amazing puns. I know we normally avoid the puns, but in the Curbsiders family spirit and the New Orleans spirit,
we decided to let the good times roll. And thank you all for being on board for listening to this.
Welcome, everyone. We're so excited to sit down here in person at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine and very happy to have you guys all here to join us and share some pearls. We have a lot of guests today. So, yes, maybe we'll start with you, Dr. Sarah Vick. Are you okay if we call you Sarah today?
That would be lovely.
Amazing. Well, can you just introduce yourself to our audience and share a little bit about yourself, both professionally and outside of medicine?
Absolutely. So I'm Sarah Vick. I'm an associate program director at the University of Kentucky. I am also a wife and mother of two, and so always very busy, but love to read and just explore different places. So New Orleans has been wonderful.
Amazing, Sarah. Thank you so much. And Sarah is a returning guest, too. We're very lucky to have you here. Maybe we'll go to Dr. Jen Spicer. Do you mind introducing yourself, kind of a one-liner, and maybe something also outside of medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Jen. I am from Emory University. I'm one of the APDs of our internal medicine residency program, and I'm an infectious disease specialist, which always makes this a fun conference to come to and hang out with my generalist friends and some of my specialist friends. I am a wife and a dog mom, and we recently moved over the last year into a new house that has a lovely outdoor area, and I have enjoyed nothing more than the Atlanta weather recently and sitting outside and just enjoying the outdoors.
Yeah, we don't know what the outdoors is like. Well, you do, Molly, but in the Bay Area, everything is like 54 degrees, and there's like a 2x2 foot area of outdoors per like location. You know, we do have, I guess, a very large park. It's larger than Central Park, but not as much of a season variation. But on that note, let's go to Dr. Vidya Gopinath. Do you mind if we call you Vidya?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Amazing. Do you mind sharing your introduction and a one-liner with something outside of medicine?
So my name is Vidya Gopinath. I'm the primary care program director at the University of Utah. My clinical focus is women's health. And I recently moved from gorgeous New England to Salt Lake City, Utah. And so I'm really enjoying the Mountain West. And I've been enjoying the last few days of being very pregnant and walking around New Orleans eating a lot of fried shrimp. So that's been delightful.
And Dr. Siobhan Onuma, do you mind if we call you Siobhan?
Nope, not at all.
Amazing. Do you mind sharing a little bit about yourself and a one-liner that might include something outside of medicine as well?
Sure. Well, I'm Siobhan Onuma. I am the Internal Medicine Residency Program Director at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Very interesting times these days. I clinically am a primary care doc, and I do some inpatient medicine and also an HIV specialist. I'm a mother of two boys that keep me busy as well. So lots of fun. And I am a lover of music, food, travel and books. So I've really been enjoying being here in New Orleans, which is like a second home for me. I actually did undergrad in med school here. So yes, it's been very nostalgic.
Amazing. We might need to pick your brain for some afternoon ideas because we don't fly out till later. So.
Happy to share.
Well, Siobhan, other than enjoying being back in New Orleans, what's really been special about being here this week at the conference and kind of anything that you want to sort of just general reflections or?
I always love coming to AIM. You know, it's just great to connect with folks that are kind of going through some of the same things. You know, we get to share ideas and also commiserate sometimes too. So that's always helpful. And so I've just enjoyed like networking, connecting, meeting new people, seeing some old folks as well and learning new ideas. I think one thing I've been really surprised by, we had had a workshop on the first day on advising, and then I saw that there are a lot of workshops on advising, and so it seems like it's a hot topic. So I guess surprising in a good way in that we really want to make sure we are, helping the students and residents to, get to that next step and really support them throughout their careers. So that's been cool to see.
Very cool. And Vidya, how about you? How's your experience been at the conference?
It has been great. There have been so many wonderful workshops. And, you know, it's really hard to fit in time to go to workshops when there are so many old friends around. But the first workshop I went to, I got to do both. I went to Mind the Gap, the creation and implementation of a comprehensive board prep curriculum by an awesome crew from Brown, Zane Elfinek, Hayes Baker, Sarah Freeman, and Alexis Jacobson. And they were really reflecting on that big drop in ABIM board pass rates. So it went from 93% in 2020 to 87% in 2023. And I think when they were giving those numbers, there was a lot of nods in the room like, okay, it wasn't just us and little sighs of relief. And so they talked about their two-pronged program, a comprehensive board prep curriculum and individualized learning programs. So they did two didactic sessions a week, and then some coaching for anybody who was under the 35th percentile on the ITE. And they did gamification, interactive didactics, some evening events at people's houses. And it was a really successful program. And they highlighted some really great resources as well. So there's a self-assessment tool on MedEd Portal that I hadn't heard of by Dr. Garacio that has like learner self-assessments and suggestions. And I was really excited to have that resource for the future.
I love that. And it sounds like Jen went to the same workshop as Vidya.
Yes, it was such a great workshop. And I think for me, two things I really took away from that. One was I loved how they were incorporating the learning sciences very explicitly into their curriculum. So they talked about using spaced repetition with questions at the end of the week that were focused on sessions from the week. And that was chief led, which I think is important, both because the chiefs have such a great knowledge of, you know, what the residents need to know. They just took boards. People listen to them, right? And then they're able to kind of adjust the session at the time with the learners. So that was really interesting to me. The other thing they talked about that we've debated back and forth a lot at our program is whether they should be using kind of specialists or internists to teach the content. And even though I'm a little biased as a specialist, I actually think using an internist to teach the content when you're doing board prep is much better in a lot of ways. Like some specialists are really good at minding that gap of really thinking about, you know, what do residents really need to know? But sometimes we get a little too excited and want to like add in pearls that are just like not at the right level. And so I think that that is something that I am taking back and thinking about. And even could we use like chiefs because they have such great cognitive congruence with the learners at that point. So that was something that was exciting to me to listen to and really got me thinking about our program.
And I wonder, because between Dr. Spicer and Dr. Onuma, we have HIV ID and, you know, interests and specialty. So I wonder, Siobhan, do you have a thought around that and kind of the teaching approach there?
Yeah, I think you need a bit of both, honestly. I think to get both perspectives, but I agree, you have to make sure that the specialists are toning it down to what we need for general internists for sure. And I was just going to say, I did not go to that workshop, but I just before this recording went to another workshop on you. Yes.
I was there too. It was wonderful.
Wasn't it? It was so helpful.
Wait, this, tell us more.
Yes, this was I'm Just a Bad Test Taker, Effective Strategies for Remediating Medical Knowledge Deficiencies and Enhancing Board Pass Rates. So it was Andrea Carter, Amy Farkas, Andrew Klein, and Casey McQuaid. So they, you know, started with the data as well, really gave some strategies for, you know, different reasons why someone may not be performing as well on the ITE, the training exam. And so, you know, from whether it's anxiety, whether it's more medical knowledge, study habits or have you. And so they gave us some really good tools, frameworks. We worked through some cases, and I, too, am coming back, you know, thinking about, you know, what we do to support the learners. I would say, and not just those that are performing low. I think I have some tools for those that are, you know, where they should be, but just helping to, you know, support them as they continue to move it, because we're going to be tested across, you know, our training or not training, but careers. So I think they had a lot of great tools. I like the podcast, especially.
I thought the resources they provided mm-hmm. were absolutely fabulous. And I think it really hits on those kind of multiple domains of teaching adult learners. And I really appreciated how they sort of picked some incredibly challenging cases that we all really face in these jobs. But I think my number one takeaway is, like, it made me feel better that it wasn't just me. I feel like I am always having those conversations and I'm like, is it just me in my program? But it's clearly not. And so I, much like you, felt like that was such a wonderful framework to be able to approach those residents.
Yeah. It was like standing room only. So on the last day of the conference, that says a lot that we were all thinking the same thing.
I think that is one of the amazing things about coming to AIM is just feeling that energy together. And we are all going through the same things and being able to commiserate and support each other and learn from best practices. Sarah or Siobhan, do you either of you have a specific like example of a resource or maybe a really quick highlight of a case and how they approach that specifically?
So they talked a lot about MixApp, of course, you know, but they also talked about really good reading sources where many of our residents really have a desire to read up to date, for example. But sometimes that's so specific and so sort of down the rabbit hole that they highlighted more of the like Annals in the Clinic or some of those kind of more general review articles, as well as just reading within MixApp. But I also appreciated there's a section they talked about adult learning strategies where it's not necessarily I have so many residents who come and be like, I'm going to do the entire cardiology section. Then I'm going to do the entire GI section. But really, we know that it's kind of that overlapping. I'm going to do a little room and a little of this and a little of that. And then repeatedly coming back and recalling that information is actually the best way to learn and retain it. And so I think that those were my main things of the resources that they talked about was fabulous.
Yes. And I love when they give you a handout that you're going to take home with you. So I still have mine here. And so as I was mentioning, they had more TED Talks on mindset and grit for those test takers that feel like, you know, they get anxiety. Oh, I'm a bad test taker. So they have The Power of Belief, The Key to Success, Grit, and Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. So I have not looked at these yet, but the presenters did say they use these and it's been helpful for their learners.
And then the last piece was just the Make It Stick book, which is a fabulous resource for just learning and how to actually like retain information.
I love that. I feel like we had a episode on the science of learning, but now I'm like, should we kind of, you know, 2.0 that with like the learning strategies that were discussed. And I think, Siobhan, you mentioned like there's also tips for people not who are failing the ITE maybe, but people who have areas for improvement and that you were going to take home kind of tools relative to that. Are there specific ones that you want to mention?
Yes. The last case that they talked about was one of the you know, learners. As we know, a lot of our residents are going into different specialties. And so one was going into cardiology. And so she was nailing it on cardiology, but all of the other subjects, not so much. And so some of the strategies, actually, this came from one of the audience members, too, was from the case they saw that she was an educator as well. So she would learn all there was to know about GDMT and teach and what have you. And so one strategy was like, perhaps giving for the next couple of months, these are the areas that you need to teach about. And so that would prompt her to, you know, really solidify her knowledge there, practice some mix-up questions and what have you in those areas.
I love that. Maybe even like a little curbsetters teach, you know, slices.
I love that.
Yeah, exactly. Where can we integrate the podcast and the education? Well, that was amazing. I feel like I also just went to a workshop that, you know, I feel like the last day there's like some heavy hitters and they really kind of blow you out of the water. The one that I went to was Read More, Know More, Teaching Learners to Maximize Feedback. And this was with Margot Cohen, Ashok Lingana, Ian Ross, and Peter Yen. And they kind of covered one of my favorite books, which is Thanks for the Feedback, and kind of talked about a lot of the triggers that come with feedback, the identity triggers, the truth triggers, the relationship triggers. But then I thought they did something really interesting, which is that they kind of gave examples of defensive responses to each of those triggers. So when somebody kind of gives you feedback and then you do something called wrong spotting, where you're like, I'm going to point out what was wrong about that feedback. And like the, you know, that I'm actually not just a, you know, internist, I'm an addiction medicine specialist and you got that wrong or something. And they used pop culture, like movie references to kind of describe it. And the one that they showed was with Will Ferrell, who was a cop getting feedback. I forget the movie right at this exact moment, but basically somebody was like, I wouldn't trust you to be a cop anywhere. And Mark Wahlberg was the other actor. And he was like, if I was a lion in the ocean and you were a tuna, I would eat you. And then Will Ferrell's like, first of all, a lion would never be in the ocean. And second of all, an 80-pound tuna would have like 30 of its friends and you would get destroyed. And it was like that type of wrong spotting example that like you'll never forget. And then there were a few other kind of defensive responses, ones around discrediting, where you kind of minimize either the competence or the name, like basically call people names. And they showed it a clip from Parks and Rec where that happened. And then another one was around switch tracking, where you kind of like hear that someone's telling you, you know, something that they think is true, but that triggers something for you. So you change the topic entirely and go to like a different subject area that you want to give them feedback about. And they showed a clip from The Office where Steve Carell is telling Toby about like how much he hates him after Toby's like, you can't have children in a casino. Like he's just trying to give him like real feedback about how insane his idea was. But then, you know, Steve Carell turns it around and is like, there's so much that I don't like about you, Toby. And why do you have to be like you? You know, and so it's kind of that switch approach, which I think we haven't had the moments of like naming those things. So I think it's not just like, what do I do when these maladaptive responses happen? But it's like, can I name what maladaptive response is happening and kind of in myself be like, what do I do next? So I thought that was a really interesting one.
I love that. And it, I think, highlights the fact that we're all sort of struggling with these emotional conversations. And we actually sat down with two presenters who talked about crucial conversations and how to use personality awareness to improve communication through conflict. And Siobhan, I know you also went to a different session that talked about a similar thing. So I think the fact that there are so many sessions around communication and sharing difficult news and processing that news really highlights that this is such important information. It's something we're all struggling with.
Yes, I loved, this was one of my favorite workshops. It was Embracing Conflict and Crucial Conversations with Confidence by Abby Spencer, Rhonda Murad, and Kelly Cornick. I think one of the reasons I love coming to AIM and I love this workshop is because you get to talk to people in all areas of academic medicine. And so this workshop was by faculty members that have had various, you know, experiences or careers in academic medicine, or roles, I should say. And then Kelly Cornick is like, you know, administrator, extraordinaire. Anyone that's ever been to AIM probably knows her. And so it was great for them to, you know, share their experiences with their different roles. And in the, you know, when they do the roll call and see who's in the room, literally there was this folks that UME, GME, coordinators, executive administrators, you know, chairs, everyone. And so I think this is an area I read a lot about, but never feel like, you know, I'm an expert in how to handle these crucial conversations. And I know academic medicine, where, you know, it's a time right now, or medicine in general, just kind of tumultuous times, and, you know, being able to handle these conversations with ease and what have you, I think is so important to continue. So they started off with a discussion of the Thomas Hillman conflict model instrument, TKI, that I think most people are familiar with. And that just really set the stage. Then they provided some helpful tips for, you know, framing these conversations, but also acknowledging the emotions behind it. And, you know, one thing I liked, for example, they talked about thinking about what type of asker you are. You know, if you're someone that maybe wait, you get all the information and you make sure your ask is so perfect that the only answer would be yes, versus you're someone that, you know, I'm just going to ask for the sake of asking because, you know, worst they could do is say no. Then how you approach when someone is asking you something, actually, that's impacted and what your response or reaction might be. So I thought that that was really helpful. I love when people give you like some practical tools and things that you're going to use in your future conversation. So things like, you know, what would it take to, you know, when you're faced with that no, when you're having this crucial conversation, but that is really helping you to figure out how can we collaborate and get to that yes, or, you know, just really opening up that possibility, I thought was really helpful. And then finally, they really shared, again, books. I'm a lover of books. Of course, you know, the classic Crucial Conversations, Dare to Lead, really anything by Brené Brown. I love at least. But some new ones that I have to add to my list, Influence is Your Superpower by Zoe Chance. I have not read that one. And then another one, Nonviolent Communication, which is a little bit older, but it's still I haven't read yet. Marshall Rosenberg as well. And they kind of ended with this, don't listen to the word, listen for the need is a helpful like framework when we're having these crucial conversations and just kind of trying to take away the emotion and really like, what's the need? What's the problem we're trying to solve? Where can we meet in the middle?
It's amazing. I feel like we just got the like cliff notes of that workshop. I'm like, I don't even need to go. Sean just told us. I think, you know, there were other folks who also, you know, I don't know if other folks wanted to share kind of impacts from kind of communication workshops or even the, you know, the same crucial conversations ones or others than what people wanted to share.
I don't have one on directly on communication, although it's going to come at the end. I think the hard thing about this conference for me is there were about 5 workshops at every session that I wanted to go to. But I do appreciate that they keep the day with enough breaks that you can network. So, I mean, it's pros, cons. But I think one of the Crucial Conversations workshops was actually at the same time as the update in the like systematic review of the GME literature session. So I went to, it was titled Update in Internal Medicine, Graduate Medical Education, Systematic Review. A literature review of high quality medical education research in 2024, which is a mouthful, by Drs. Elena Furr, Evelyn Murray, Alexander Rittenberg, and Mary Grace Zetkulik. And it's actually Stephanie Call, who organizes this every year and has been doing it for years. So this is a session I go to every year. And a disclaimer that I was lucky enough this year to be one of the reviewers for it. So they go through all of the literature for the last year. I mean, thousands of papers, and narrow it down using this systematic process to kind of relevant things and really high quality literature. So it's things of interest and things that are high quality, and then they try to summarize it in an hour, which is a really, really big call. And so one of the things they talked about actually was communication. It was one of the last studies that I feel like we didn't have as much time to talk about, but it was looking at EHR workload for male versus female residents. And we know the literature in the larger community, right? Like we've seen that there's a disparate burden, but this talked about it in the residents, and they did a really great job of even comparing like for the same number of patients they saw for the same number of tests. And it made me think about during training how there are a lot of other things that that decreases time for, right? And this was the discussion that came up at the very end, because we know training's really busy. And so if we have female residents spending a lot more time on their inbox in a limited time setting, and they can't spend as much time on research or other things. And so people brought up at the very end, like, should we think about our inbox pools and balancing by like gender, right? Like, because you have a shared pool, or do we need to think about other aspects to kind of deal with that? So that was something really interesting that I actually plan to bring up at our residency leadership. I need to look into the actual study in a little bit more depth to fully understand some of the limitations. But that was that one of the interesting ones at the end. And I think the other high-yield study, I recommend everybody look through all the slides, because, I mean, there were, I think, 10 studies they went through that were all very interesting. But one they talked about was the RCT looking at diagnostic reasoning of large language models, physicians using large language models versus physicians using just traditional resources. And the bottom line was that there was actually no difference, and it was a really robust look at it. But I think the interesting part that I don't think has been emphasized in that study is that they had a someone outside of medicine who's, you know, like a data scientist, put a prompt into a large language model to see how the large language model alone did, right? And it did better. And I think that scares some people, like, oh, does this mean that physicians aren't useful? But I think what it shows is that you need to train physicians to use it, because they didn't train physicians in the study to use it appropriately. And I think it shows the added power if we actually train physicians to use it appropriately. So I see a lot of other ideas and expressions in the group that I love to hear. But that was a really interesting study to me about how, you know, we actually need to think about training in our programs right now, because this is something I think many of us are largely ignoring for a while until we see what happens. And we probably need to be doing a little bit more.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for summarizing that one, because I had tried to go, but was a little bit late and it was standing room out the door. So I'm glad I got to hear it from you. But yeah, you and I were talking about kind of that whole AI plugging in the case and what that really means for us. And my take is that a case is written in a particular way to yield a specific answer or a specific differential. And that is so much different than seeing a patient and being able to create that case from the history, from the chart, from the data that you have. And so I think it's super interesting, but I also I'm not sure how it yet like actually translates into clinical practice. But there were a lot of sessions on AI and electronic work. And one that I went to that was really interesting that made me think about the increased messages or increased message time for women. And Vidya, I saw you had some responses to that, so I'd love to hear. But it was about using harnessing EHR user analytics to provide individual feedback to improve continuity clinic intervisit care. And it was given by Dr. Zachary Boggs, Heather Frazier, Jason Ojeda, and Ashley Trazak. Sorry. But it was really highlighting how to use Epic Signal data, which I have gotten from our data analysts in the past for faculty, and I'm excited to use it for our residents as well. But just showing kind of the difference between how people manage their inbox. And I think so many programs really give so little oversight to the intervisit care, and it is a big part of what we do in outpatient medicine. So they cited a study published by Stelling in 2023, where 21% of PDs said that they were aware of a patient safety event related to unsupervised intervisit care, but a third of programs had absolutely no oversight, which is a little scary. But basically, they were looking at the signal data to say how much time people were spending on each message, how long each message or prescription was sitting in the inbox, and kind of using that to phenotype different learners to be able to target their training and care around it. So they kind of gave the example of someone who was inefficient. So they're spending a lot of time in the inbox, but they're not replying to the messages on time. And that person would need a different kind of coaching compared to someone who's sort of the under-checker that, you know, they only go in once a week and clear it out really fast, but maybe aren't doing the greatest job of really addressing everything. But Vidya, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the women's.
I'm
very interested in and aware of the data on, you know, the amount of time female physicians versus male physicians spend with patients, the number of messages we get. And then at home, my husband is a family medicine doctor, and seeing, like, listening to his phone calls is as if a patient were to call him or he calls somebody back, just the duration, the tone, it's all, I also get to live it and see see our differences in basket management and I think some of the expectations of female or male physicians. And I think a lot of these differences just feel so complex and hard to address, and, you know, underlying gender expectations and, you know, women listen more and all these things. And so trying to find concrete solutions, I feel like we spend a lot of time pointing out this data. Mm-hmm. And so I really love that they had a solution, like, okay, these pools, you can't have, you know, an in-basket pool of four female residents. That'll look really different than an in-basket pool of four male residents. And really knowing all of these discrepancies, like, can we get into the solution finding of how this looks to make this a more equitable mm-hmm. profession for our male and female trainees and physicians.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I was sitting here thinking it. I need to go home and look at our firms and see, you know, have we balanced that out? So thank you for highlighting that.
Well, I was just about to say, and I think, Jen, you mentioned this too, it's like in that systematic review time, it sounds like people were starting to come up with solutions or coming up with suggestions. And I don't know, Vidya or the whole group, if folks have thoughts around that, because I think if anything, AIM is a conversation starter and kind of like an ultimate solutions, like, think tank place where you kind of are with like-minded individuals who care about the same thing and patients and education. And it's a really great generative place for ideas. So I wonder, like, if folks had anything come to mind relative to that question around communication, gender differences, or, you know, anything really, like the plenary, you know, any thoughts around kind of solutions or next steps maybe.
I think one other thing I thought about during that time was, do we need to look at the volume of messages people get and provide them more protected inbox time, right? Or is there a way to change to make sure that people are having kind of like an equal amount of average work, or, you know, in addition to balancing pools? But that was one thing that I thought about during that moment.
Yeah, actually, this came up just before I had it here. Our inbox intervisit. So we actually do some work around intervisit in these firms so that folks are covering when they're not in their, you know, AMBO or plus 1 week, we call it. So we had a resident who happened to be on the outpatient side, followed by a resident that had done a primary care elective, which means that she had a number of tasks that are carrying over for a heavier, and these are third years too, so they see more patients, they have more follow-up. And it had not dawned on me that, you know, we haven't really adjusted the protected time for in-basket management for the third years that do have more follow-up. And so I love the idea of using, you know, data, to one, look individually and see how is it efficiency or whatever, you know, the deficit, if there is a deficit maybe, or just how we can, you know, coach them to have better intervisit care. But then also looking at the data to see just like the volume and whether it's gender, whether it's the number of patients that they're seeing, and how we can maybe adjust our systems on the back end or the front end, actually.
I admit this is the moment where I realize I'm a hospitalist, but I'm also married to a primary care physician. And I think having those conversations with my residents who are dealing with those large volumes, as you mentioned, you know, and we don't necessarily have that protected time when we're in the CCU, the MICU, et cetera. And so being able to be more intentional about that, because you're right, those intervisit care is where so much of that high value, but also high risk comes in. And so how do you teach that to residents in a meaningful way, but also make sure that they're not having too much burden?
I think there's so much we do in the primary care setting that we assume patients and our trainees know. There was a really great session about spicing up your lectures to make them more interactive. And one of the lectures, or one of the interactive didactic sessions they were talking about was about doing FMLA paperwork and just like, how do you do all that paperwork of clinic? And I think kind of within the intravisit care of like being really intentional about teaching these skills. And then to the point of the in-basket, that when I have a new patient, you know, I talk about what's a good thing for a MyChart message? When do you call? Like, how do you kind of navigate our clinic? What, do we have sick visits? Things like that. And that residents spend a lot less time in clinic. And so a lot of these things, they might not be doing kind of that intentional teaching. They might not be, you know, best optimizing the resources of the clinic or preparing their patients for how long it takes to get back to people about certain messages. And so I think this intentionality over a lot of these non, like how to treat heart failure topics are just so important to make them sustainable, non-burned out clinicians in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that kind of management reasoning or sort of getting stuff done teaching, like we feel like isn't valuable because it's not the latest guidelines for heart failure, but it is so valuable for our trainees and really is important to be able to get our jobs done. So I think absolutely key to work that into our, you know, our orientations or our clinic, you know, re-upping to the second years and just making sure that that's something that's continued to be followed up on and continue to be taught. Well, Ira, I know you went to a workshop that you wanted to highlight. Can we hear more about clinical reasoning?
Yeah, Molly, thank you. I appreciate you so much for knowing that I really wanted to talk about this workshop. This is called Put the Shark Before the Horse, Applying Roadmaps to Teach Clinical Reasoning at the Bedside. This was presented by Zainab Kubulay, Satya Patel, Ashley Saito, and Chase Weber. These are all physicians. And they basically started off by saying, hey, why is this important? It's because teaching clinical reasoning saves lives. They shared an article that reported that diagnostic errors were linked to nearly 800,000 deaths or cases of permanent disability each year. So they were like, this is important. We got to know how to do it better. And they shared two roadmaps for teaching clinical reasoning. The four square prioritized differential and the diagnostic timeout. I'm obsessed with the four squares, so I'm going to focus on that. But those four squares, the top left was the type one, almost identical diagnosis between the problem representation items and the typical kind of illness script for that diagnosis. The top right square was the type 1B differential, which is the threat to life with, you know, death within minutes, essentially. And the bottom left, type 2B, was the less likely diagnosis. The bottom right, the type 3, was unlikely. And they really made this exciting because in addition to four squares, they put animals on these squares. So they said, you know, the top left, most likely type 1 is a horse. The type 1B, the threat to life, is a shark. And then the type 2B, which is less likely, is a goat. And then the type 3B, you're in the mud. It's really unlikely. And that's a pig. And I really love that they would kind of ask students to really construct not only a problem representation, but use that problem representation to then go through this four square prioritized differential and kind of say out loud what they think is truly, you know, most likely, threat to life, less likely, and unlikely. So really kind of getting in the weeds, in the animals, and making sure it's fun.
I love that because it kind of takes us a little bit beyond the what's most likely, what's a can't miss, what's an unlikely but possible, and adds in the goat, I guess.
I know. and adds some prioritization too, which I think is really important because I think sometimes we're just like throwing stuff out there, but it's really nice to, you know, if you're on rounds or maybe in clinic, that you just flip over a piece of paper, write these four squares down, and have the learner that's working with you kind of use the problem representation that they came up with and apply that when they're prioritizing their differential diagnosis.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that, Ira.
Yeah, I was thinking just to go off of making things spicier and potentially more exciting, would love to hear from Sarah about kind of the professionalism toolkit and also Siobhan in terms of the getting out of didactics and into the district, which I think is a very spicy title. Would love to hear about that. But Sarah, do you want to take us away?
Absolutely. So the session was entitled Building Your Professionalism Coaching Toolbox. And similarly to kind of what other guests have said, this was also a topic that was very popular this week, but it was presented by some of my colleagues from the University of Kentucky, Dr. Christy Deep, Dr. Devin Oler, and Dr. Megan Woolock. And they really talk about kind of, it's very hard to create a plan, any remediation plan, whether it's medical knowledge or anything, without actually making the appropriate diagnosis. And so they walk through this framework of like how you decide what that kind of professionalism lesion is and how you coach through that. Because someone who's dealing with stressful times at home or, you know, having a difficult, you know, rotation block or whatever is very different than someone who is behaving unprofessionally for other reasons. And so I really appreciated how they spent a lot of time walking through kind of the different domains. I mean, specifically looking at things like habits or relationships. Is it perception? Is it attitudes? Is it personal experiences on that rotation in the past or whatever it may be? And so they walk through some cases of just how you deal with different residents in different situations. And I certainly appreciated the, it was similarly standing room only, very robust conversation. But I think what I felt in the room is a lot more of just the angst when approaching professionalism remediation rather than medical knowledge, et cetera. Because I feel like oftentimes not only do we have our own sort of thoughts and opinions about certain situations and how we should act, but also the trainee is coming in potentially either unaware or does not feel like it's an issue. And so I really thought that some of the conversations about like emotional intelligence and like fitness for duty, is that something that as program directors we need to be paying attention to, obviously. And so I really appreciated having kind of those conversations and being able to sort of coach through criticism and walking alongside residents as they're in some of these very emotionally fraught moments.
Yes, that sounds like a powerful workshop. And I think, you know, it's something that I struggle with as well. But, you know, as educators, it's so important because we need to owe it to that learner. And literally, we have to say that for that learner. I don't think they always see it as that we're doing this for you and your career. But then also, you know, what we owe to society and the communities that they'll be serving, because we know that these sometimes even what the learner may think is a minor issue really can, you know, balloon into something, you know, potentially dangerous or just impact a lot of folks. And so thank you for sharing the highlights from that. So the workshop with a spicy title, Out of Didactics and Into the District by Ashley Duckett, Chelsea Pass. They're from Medical University of South Carolina, and then Caitlin Gordon and Aaron Murphy from University of Louisville. This was really interesting. I love to hear. I'm a curriculum development nerd. If I could spend all of my day, you know, like just making up new curriculum, oh my goodness, I would just be in heaven. But so they both groups explored, you know, their institution's approach to social determinants of health curriculum through community engagement in particular. And so University of Louisville talked more about a required 2-week curriculum. All of their residents go through this. I was like, wow. And then they have an academic half day workshop as well. And then MUSC talked about an optional 2-4 week elective experience, which we have like a track, which it sounds similar. And so what I liked about this workshop is that I feel like no matter where you're at in your, you know, social determinants of health curriculum or equity work or what have you, there were tools that let you know you could do this or you could enhance or revise. So they had a curriculum development tool where it's really nice. I'm actually going to use it for, it's not, you don't have to just use it for social determinants of health, it's for anything. But the tool basically has you think about what's the learning gap, what are the areas of need, then what's the setting for the teaching, you know, whether it's community or outpatient, inpatient, community setting, classroom, and what have you. Specifically, the areas of social determinants of health teaching interests, then the potential collaborations. And so they had us think about, you know, not just the collaborations within our departments, think about social work, pharmacy, community organizations, your local government, what have you, the VA. And then think about what support staff you need, of course, the curricular development resources, and then what barriers. You know, we always got to think about those barriers. I just want to, you know, commend them, both groups. They're doing incredible work. When I looked at some of the example schedules, especially for the required rotation and how they are able to engage with the community on, you know, so many different levels, and it's sustained. And that was really important. They even talked about how this is a rotation that they cannot get pulled from. And so it just really shows the importance of this experience. And then they showed the data that, you know, of course, not all residents are going to be super happy about taking away maybe that specialty elective experience that they want to take for the sixth time. But, you know, that they really did gain this perspective and how it was going to help them be a better clinician no matter what field that they were going into. So I thought it was well done.
That's amazing. Did they share some specific examples of what they were doing with the community?
Yes, they did. So they have a few different things. They have like substance use disorder rounding in a community clinic. They also have, and I'm putting up quotation marks about volunteering because Kelly, one of the administrators, reminded us if they're doing something during work hours, it is not volunteering. But for instance, working with a food bank, you know, so they had also going to a middle school, and I think that was more about kind of helping build the pathway. So just different. Oh, a community group practice as well. I think they were doing like community therapy or groups like that. So, you know, it was really interesting that I think this was University of Louisville, yes, was just talking about how, you know, she grew up there, but had also learned about other resources through, you know, trying to make these network collaborations with different community partners. And then, you know, it did come up to some of us in the audience were, you know, just asking, like, how do you make sure that this is not more of a burden on our community partners and that we're having the impact and the outcomes? And it seems like it has been a, you know, good mutual arrangement. And I think the fact that the program actually makes sure that this is not something that is, you know, I'm just going to drop in here and there, that, you know, you see the importance, they frame it, they do a lot of training to like orientation to make sure that the learners are coming in with a certain lens when they're working with their community partners.
I love that example of ways of getting us out of the classroom and getting us into a more interactive and more real situation, because I think that's super powerful for learning. One of my favorite things about coming to AIM is that most of these sessions are taught by people that are really passionate about education. And so it's really exciting to see different approaches to teaching, and just a lot of the workshops are very interactive. I'm wondering if anyone has, even if they don't want to focus specifically on the content, were there any really amazing deliveries of the content or really cool ways of engaging the audience?
So I have one that I'm a little biased about, but I think Molly, you may have gone to as well. It was our chief residents from Emory did one with the chiefs about dealing with learners and faculty in the room. And so I'd be interested in what you thought about how they did it, because the room was very excited and engaged, and they did some role plays, which most people like kind of groan about, but I feel like went really well in the room.
Yeah, yeah. It was a really fun session. And I think I texted you during it. I was like, these guys are amazing presenters. it was called But Wait, I Have a Question, Strategies for Chief Residents to Master Group Facilitation While Teaching, by Drs. Kylie Anthony, Daniel Barboto, James Penoyer, and Soyu Alexander Zhang. And they just had a really great flow, I felt like, between the four of them, that, you know, they would give a little bit of a didactic and then give some examples. Their slides were really beautiful and clear. And then they split us up into these groups to pretend to be different types of learners that were either kind of the disengaged learner, and they had given specific strategies to try to draw them in, you know, the off-the-wall learner who just is interrupting all the time and asking too many questions, and, you know, kind of some tips of how to keep it a little more structured and help them stay focused. And then I think it was mostly chief residents in the room, hearing them all talk about the tangential faculty was just amazing. Like, you could tell it so resonated with them. And
so I'll just add that my chief residents, they talked about that at dinner. They talked about this workshop. So great feedback. I am sometimes that tangential faculty member. So
I think you're among friends. I think you're all that person. Maybe still are that person, yeah.
And I think the funniest moment, things got really meta in the workshop, but there was also a faculty member in the back, and they're going through kind of how the session went. And one of the things they talked about was, how do you manage the expert faculty in the room, right? And so this faculty member runs morning report all the time. And so he actually was like functioning as the expert faculty member in the room. And as he was talking and like providing his tips and advice, he reflected in the moment, he's like, and right now I'm kind of being that expert faculty member in the room. And then they use the strategy to like move it along. And it was the most meta moment that I've had at this conference.
Yeah. Anyone else? We haven't covered kind of reactions to the plenary. And specifically when I'm asking about the plenary, this is the opening plenary with Dr. Lisa Rosenbaum, medical training at a crossroads, getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. But I think one of the things was like this discussion around what medicine is for people and how can we find the meaning in medicine, meaning in our job, and what that can do, which is, you know, prevent burnout, or, you know, kind of amplify us as human beings and, you know, give us that soul feeling. But I do, that was, I think, one of the big take homes for me is like, what are we doing to instill that meaning in medicine and education for ourselves and for the people that we're teaching? Because I still, you know, I'm still always looking for solutions. So, you know, edits and feedback, welcome. But I think that is a huge part of at least this AIM Week 25 for me.
I've had so many thoughts on this topic in the last year or two in this application cycle. I would feel very injured when someone was like, I really am excited about primary care. I just really like weekends. And I would be like, oh my gosh, like,
me too.
And also, like, but primary care is more than like a choice for work-life balance and weekends. It's like, but do you love the patients? Do you like the longitudinal stuff? Do you like problem solving, how to ensure people get preventive care? And so I had all of these thoughts that I was so, you know, disorganized and clumsily naming in my head. And then I feel like Lisa Rosenbaum was phenomenal at kind of identifying this and like prompted self some introspection of like, okay, I think this is because I have a very different perspective on my job. I don't view my job as a job. I view it as a calling. And so it's hard for me to hear people be like, yeah, this is great. I can leave at 5:30. And know that this is about a balance and that not everyone is going to view their job as their calling and feel injured when it's viewed by others. It's just like, yeah, a thing that you do for ideally 40 hours a week. Because, you know, that wasn't how we were trained. That wasn't our reality. And that isn't why we picked our jobs. But that isn't why everyone is motivated. And so I think just her naming that and really explaining why the perspective around medicine has changed among the new trainees, and then really articulating that the way that they feel about wellness is a little bit how I feel about work. And I was like, oh, because, you know, wellness is like, go outside, make sure you do some walking, like eat vegetables, but not a comprehensive life plan for me. And that is a cultural difference that I feel like she just did such a phenomenal job naming things, identifying trends, and kind of organizing what maybe some of us have been thinking about a lot.
And I think like it's also not everybody in different generation. I like how she broke down and broke away from the generation thing, because I think we do generation generalizing a lot, but it is not everybody. And everybody in all generations, there's some people who view it as a job, some who view it as a calling. And I don't know, it's very interesting, especially like as somebody in infectious disease in our specialty, you know, there's people generally go into it because they feel like you have to really, really love it and feel a passion for it, you know, because there's not, it's like very rewarding. But there's a lot of like negatives that people take, I think, similar to some of the primary care stuff and other, you know, some of the like pediatric fields. And so I do think we tend to have a lot of people who see it as a calling. But then like during times where, you know, things are threatened right now, like funding and stuff like that, I think that it makes it really hard and there's so much more moral injury. And then it makes you start like really thinking about like, I don't know. I've just been a very, you know, reflective space right now going through kind of all of this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it, you know, for me, just what Vidya and Jen said, just piggybacking on a couple of things. Yeah, so, you know, so my program recently unionized, and throughout that process, people had so many different emotions and thoughts, and you know, and that includes the trainees. Maybe not everyone was on board, as well as the faculty and, you know, what their thoughts were. And I had more of a kind of a neutral approach, right? This is what they need to do and what have you. And I think it's the same, you know, when we think about this. Is it a calling? Has medicine lost this sacredness that, you know, Lisa talked about? And I love what you said, Avidia, about, you know, thinking about why am I reacting to this a certain way? And so it even brought it back to my Crucial Conversations workshop where one of the participants said that when she's working with her, I think, program director or someone that's really close to her, and she's feeling a certain way, she literally says, the story that I'm telling myself is, and that really helps that you frame about, actually, this is what I am feeling. And let me say this out loud. And I think we need to think about that as far as, you know, whether medicine is a calling or this is a story I'm telling myself. But it doesn't mean that perhaps it is a job, but does it mean that they can do their job any less, you know, effectively than the person that decides that medicine is a calling? You know, if I just say this, I'm just doing this to make an income or what have you, doesn't mean that they're not going to be a good physician and that patients won't be impacted positively by them.
Totally. I think, Siobhan, one thing that you said that I think Vidya noted for me right after this plenary was like the ladder of inference of like, what's the actual data? You know, okay, so this resident is telling me that they need to leave early because of X, Y, Z thing in their life. And then what is the story that I'm telling myself? Like, what are all the assumptions I am making? Like that they don't care about medicine, that they don't see it as a calling or, you know, whatever it is. And to just like walk back down that ladder is really important because I think when you're having those conversations, you can definitely add in a lot of, we'll say, I don't want to say not crucial, but maybe like not appropriate components to it if you're making those assumptions and kind of like, and then also very deeply holding them and making them like your beliefs, essentially. I think that Lisa kind of, you know, she's a reporter, right? So she like kind of took it back and was like, this is a situation. Let's, you know, think about it. And I think for at least our residency program, we're like, okay, we need to think more about like the spectrum between, you know, job and calling, all well-being, no well-being. Like it's something, there's something in the middle there. And can we actually name it? Can we name the differences in the approaches that we have and kind of the maybe assumptions that we're making?
Mm-hmm. I think also the more we think about and look at this as all of us together, because I think a lot of these conversations end up like we're doing an in-group and out-group type thing, right? Where we're like, okay, students or trainees or faculty. And the more we're like, we are all physicians, right? And like, what is the impact on all of us as physicians? And as soon as you kind of in-group everybody and think about it from that same perspective, I think that it changes a lot of the conversations. And so that's something I always try to reframe. And I, you know, we all have times when we, you know, we're not at our best, but I always try to reframe discussions when I'm like hearing them about like thinking about us all as the same group of people encountering many of the same issues in a little different way at different stages of our lives. But
and with the same goals.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With the same goals.
Yes.
Yeah.
Patient care.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. A touch of education.
Vidya, did you help that learner understand that primary care is not a 9-to-5 job?
Because they're in for rude awakening. I'm not sure primary care is the right choice, but
I feel like it'd be so disillusioning. Make primary care less appealing if they really knew how much time we spent outside of the 8-to-5 time frame being a primary care doctor.
We need a separate episode about how we frame and recruit for primary care, because I do think there's maybe some myths to dispel. But also, like, a calling, and, like, we mm-hmm. are a community focused on taking care of patients in a longitudinal way. And, like, mm-hmm. we do have to kind of name that for people, mm-hmm. which I think is really important when making career decisions, you know?
Yeah, well, this has been really wonderful, Pearls, and super fun to get together and chat about the conference. Any take-home points that anyone wants to share? Maybe we can go around the table. And Sarah, we can start with you.
Absolutely. I think my first take-home point is always from this conference that, like, we have such a fabulous group of medical educators across the country, and we are all doing so many wonderful, fabulous things, and it's nice to just be in a group together and talking about things. But I also think that some of the really hot topics right now are large language models, as you had mentioned, and how we use them effectively, because I often find it's garbage in, garbage out. So, like, how do we as doctors really use them effectively? But also communication. Like, I feel like there were so many workshops about effective communication strategies and how we involve our residents and do that in a meaningful way.
Yeah. I think for me, you know, just being at this conference reminds me that everybody else is experiencing the same things and we are all going through the same stuff. And it is great to connect with people outside of your institution on a more regular basis. And I have set up a lot of kind of recurring mentorship meetings and peer mentorship with people outside my institution to talk, because it just helps to get outside of your bubble sometimes. And even though it can be really tiring to, you know, come to a conference, it's like exciting, but I cannot wait to get like a long night of sleep now. I think that it reminds you why this type of stuff is important and kind of gets you excited again about everything that you're doing.
Yeah, with two little kids at home, I can't believe I've slept less each night that I've been here than at home. But yes, there's so many amazing people to see and connections to be made. And I think I've been seeing the volume of content on AI, and you know, our messages, our patient messages on my chart now come in with, you know, an AI template, and I haven't given them that much thought. And I think some more intentionality and seeing just this is such an important part of what's going to be happening in the next few years has been helpful to see. It's been a major focus of the conference here. And then I think just being inspired about curriculum development. I similarly get very excited about curriculum development, and there are just so many amazing educators here with great ideas and ways to really, I think, up our game.
Yeah, I just echo everything that has already been said. And you know, one of the take-homes or things that I love is, and in thinking about the plenaries too, but how it's so important to really, you know, focus and help our learners to see that, you know, compassion and finding meaning in medicine, and for us as educators, you know, meaning in teaching and what have you, how that is really the formula to kind of help prevent burnout and what have you too. So I think all of these strategies, I now have a whole list of other things I need to, you know, read about or slides I need to look at. But I think that's the fuel that's going to keep us going and moving forward. So I'm really excited.
I was reflecting on when you were talking about kind of the meaning in medicine, and just kind of getting together here in the room is really valuable. And in one of the episodes that we recorded a few days ago, we were talking about getting people back to conference and just the importance of being together to feel that energy and feel that passion. And even these conferences are very exhausting, it also is, you know, reminds us of what we're excited about and what we're striving towards. So I think that's huge for maintaining wellness and keeping us enjoying our jobs.
And being in this amazing community. I feel like it's so wonderful to talk to all of y'all. Like, thank you so much for taking time and energy, because it does take, like, energy to summarize and to reflect and be like, what hit home for me in this workshop? So just really appreciate that we have this incredible brain trust of a community here. That means a lot to us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of our Curbsider series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season jazz up. Ooh. And to our team behind the scenes for helping out with the show notes and CME questions. And thanks to Dr. Matt Lotto and Dr. Paul Williams for their steady beat of support on this project.
Also, thanks to the team at Podbase for editing and production support. Y'all really let the good times roll. Until next time, I'm Dr. Molly Hoybein, second lining my way out of here.
We're committed to providing you with a gumbo of brilliance, high value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsittersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals at curbsetters.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. No voodoo magic required. And I'm Dr. Ira Krzyzanowska. Thank you for joining us today, letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment straight from the big easy of internal medicine.